Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Ralph Pointer, What's Happening, Blog Talk Radio, Tuesday, February 6th, 2018. And tonight, as with every Tuesday night, our news analysis deals with an anatomy of oppression, which requires an anatomy of colonialism, which is imperialism, and an anatomy of the American capitalist system. And we feel that our program is here to help you understand your world. As some of you know, in the Pedagogy of the Oppressed by Paulo Freire, he says we should read our world. Just as you pick up a newspaper to read the news, you should read your world. And we are hoping to give you ammunition to help you read and interpret your world. And in spite of the fact that the flu is taking people down right and left, we have a full house this evening, and we're asking when people are called on to speak that you be aware. We're probably going to use a little signal tonight to let you know when you have 2 minutes left. So without further ado, we owe some people some time this evening because we had to cut them short last week, and we're going to try and make that up to them. Please be aware again, we're going to give you a little tap with the phone to remind you that you've got 2 minutes left. Brother Ralph Pointer is in the house, and he's going to be telling us what's happening. But first, his creed.
Thank you so much, Sister Betty. The overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our labors for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, move lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have taken lynching outside again. The lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes and sheroes who once protected us in our community do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up. Now is the time. Now, I've been warned that I must be brief this week. So I'm going to start with St. Augustine, the Christian, the philosopher, the Catholic philosopher, who said, "Any unjust law is no law at all." And I say, unjust application of law is now and has always been tyranny. It must be resisted by any and all means to be decided by the offended or the oppressed. Now, this week we have there's so much to talk about and so little time, but one of the most egregious things that have come through that ignorant box, the mass media, the television, was the argument that there were two sides to the killing of unarmed black people. And Al, the colonial administrator, traitor, liar, all kind of names that you could come up with, Sharpton, hosted this two sides, and he lied. He says it was to explain the other side so black people could come up with the proper nonviolent response. And so I'm going to have to go back to my life and tell a little story about my Christian mother. Loved her. She was very brilliant. And one day, at the age of 17, she called me aside and said, "Take me to the Sears and Roebuck store." It was a catalog store. This was before shopping malls and that sort of thing. And we went to the Sears and Roebuck store, catalog store. And while we were standing there, she looked at me and pointed to a rifle on the wall. It was a Marlin 30-30 lever action rifle. And she says, "If I buy that for you, will you use it?" And I said, "Well, I don't hunt. I don't do anything like that. What do I need a gun for?" And she looked at me and said, "You have challenged too many men with your fist. They're not coming for you with their fist. They're going to come after you with guns." Well, these are back in the 40s. You know, there's been a whole history of America where racist people have come after people of color with guns and lynched, and I don't have to tell that story again. And her answer was, her question was, "If I buy it, will you use it?" And my answer was, "Buy it and see." And she put down $5 and bought that Marlin 30-30 lever action rifle. and I thought I was the rightful man. I was prepared for everything. I practiced. And so I say, and this contradicts a speech I heard the other day by a young man who was in the San Francisco 8. He spoke at a meeting to support political prisoners, and he says, as far as violence goes, and he was a Black Panther, Black Liberation Army member, he said, our parents didn't teach us to become violent. Society forced us to become violent. And I wanted to stand up and say, excuse me. My mother was a very Christian woman. She ran a Christian house, and she didn't know what communism was all about. But as Fannie Lou Hamer said, we don't need anyone to tell us that we're sick and tired of being sick and tired. And they accused Martin Luther King of being a communist because we Black people could not understand oppression or not understand liberation without a communist telling us that we had to fight. I say bunk, nonsense. My good Christian mother understood the right of self-defense, and she did not intend to stand by and see an outspoken young man such as I was to be taken down and to talk nonviolence. He was aware of reality, and what we try to do on this program is bring you a little reality. And I've been given the sign to quit, so I will finish with this. I got a tweet on my cell phone to start to sign up to impeach Mr. Trump. And I say to you and to everyone who will listen, I will sign to impeach Mr. Trump when I can sign at the same time to impeach Clarence Thomas and to reinstate the case of Anita Hill, the forgotten woman in We Too. Me Too. Let us not forget those who came before us and stood up and confronted this evil society and were hurt by it. And most of all, our political prisoners stood up. They said no, and we must do better. We must bring them home, and again I say thank you to all of those out there who helped me bring dear Sister Lynn home. Thank you again, and Sister Betty has signaled me one more time.
Thank you, Brother Ralph. Just a reminder, this is allegedly Black History Month. You will forgive me if I didn't open up the show with that acknowledgement, since I'm insulted that the people who gave civilization to the world first should only get 1 month in this country. However, I would love to give a shout-out to the African dancers and drummers and singers that did the Anansi Tale at Symphony Space on Saturday evening. It was a wonderful, wonderful program. I cannot recommend it highly enough. Asayaya. I really recommend that you Google it, go to their website. They give dance classes and health programs. You should definitely follow them up. It's a wonderful program for your children. Without further ado, we want to go straight to Brother Larry Pinckney, and we see that Sister Ann is in the house, and we owe her time from last week. So, Brother Larry, our Black Panther, our liberator who freed himself, jailhouse lawyer, your mic is open.
Thank you very, very much, Sister Professor Betty Davis. Much appreciated. Greetings to all of sisters and brothers. And all of the listeners, wherever you may be. Thank you, Brother Ralph Pointer, for your words. Let me be brief and succinct. I know that there are many people waiting to speak. Today, I received an email from the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee.
Right.
And, of course, we know that Brother Leonard is among our many, many political prisoners. Mm-hmm. In a sense, today being February 6th, quite frankly, is a kind of wake-up call and sad day, but it doesn't have to be sad if we take action. February 6th, as Leonard points out, he says, quote, "I am overwhelmed that today, February 6th, is the start of my 43rd year in prison." I hope everybody thinks about that. His 43rd year in prison. My God. Let me skip down so as not to take up a lot of time. He mentions that he is dealing with a number of serious medical conditions. He mentions also, you know, he just had a heart operation. He's dealing with serious arthritis. I can go on and on. Again, in the interest of time, I will not go on and on. What I will state or read is that keep in mind what's being said about the leadership of the FBI today. We know that. We have known for decades and decades how corrupt the FBI, not only the FBI, but in particular the leadership of the FBI is. He says, quote, he says, "I know you know that the FBI files are full of information that proves my innocence. Yet many of those files are still withheld from my legal team." Now, this is 2018. Man's been in prison going on 43 years starting today. He says, "During my appeal before the Eighth Circuit, the former prosecuting attorney by the name of Lynn Crooks," isn't that an interesting last name, Crooks, C-R-O-O-K-S, yes, isn't that interesting, said to Judge Heaney, H-E-A-N-E-Y, this is what the prosecutor said, quote, "Your Honor, we do not know who killed those agents," meaning the two FBI agents. "We do not know who killed those agents. Further, we don't know what participation, if any, Mr. Peltier had in it," unquote. This should chill you. This is exactly what we need to understand across the board relating to all of our political prisoners, our brothers and sisters, our sisters and brothers. It's not about guilt or innocence. It's about the fact that these sisters and brothers stood up against oppression, stood up for the right to self-determination. So I'm not going to go on and on. I wanted to share those precious words with you from our dear brother Leonard Peltier to give you some food for thought. Again, I'm going to end. I'm going to say, as I always do, we must free our political prisoners, for in so doing, we free ourselves. All power to the people. Thank you so much. Power.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Larry. And
yes, as we said, we must free our political prisoners, and no politician anywhere can get my vote if they don't support our issue of political prisoners. How that got lost, I do understand how it got lost. And I understand the confusion about what being Christian is about. Christian, being Christian was never about nonviolence. They just put that upon us. And when I talk about what they put upon us, I hear that Martin Luther King, just like Malcolm X, they have rewritten history. And I would like to go into the monument in Washington, D.C., and all of the quotes of Martin Luther King. They were the ones that they put up around Martin Luther King were the ones that best served this evil empire. He said a lot of things. They are rewriting what he said to a negative effect, leading to our freedom or leading away from our freedom. Sister Betty.
Thank you, Brother Ralph. You should also know that if you're reading the King James Version of the Bible to begin with, you are being misled. That is not the original interpretation that the people who were Africans followed in Ethiopia. To continue, I just want to make an announcement. There are several, but this Saturday from 3 to 6, there are two major events. From 3 to 6, it's an urgent meeting for BAI. We must save BAI. We're asking you to come out to the MNN Firehouse Studio. Capital M, capital N as in Nancy, N as in Nancy. Firehouse Studio, 175 East 104th Street, between Lexington and 3rd Avenue, starting at 3 p.m. We're going to have an urgent meeting about saving BAI. And just consider being out all day, because promptly at 6 p.m., there is a beginning of the reception, and at 7 p.m., a program for Cuba's Historic Literacy Campaign. That will be taking place on the west side, 131 West 33rd Street, second floor in Manhattan. That's between 6th and 7th Avenue near Penn Station. So there are two events, Cuba's Historic Literacy Campaign, and you will be meeting their literacy teacher, Griselda Aguilera Cabrera, and it'll be from 6 on at 131 West 33rd Street. And please save BAI. You can do it.
Yes, we can.
On February from 3 to 6 at the Firehouse, 170 East 104th Street. Sister Ann, your mic is open.
Oh, thank you so much, Sister Betty. Well, I was going to read Leonard's statement, but since we've already read part of it, I would just like to say there is also an online petition that is being circulating internationally that people can sign and download. That's part of the letter. It's at gopetition.com, and it's an international demand for the immediate freedom of indigenous political prisoner Leonard Peltier, wrongfully imprisoned for 42 years. So people should go to gopetition.com and look for international demand for the immediate release of Leonard Peltier, and it will come up. Just went out today. That's why it was included in his statement. But since we had already spoken, you know, well, Leonard obviously is a totally innocent person who has been imprisoned all these years, totally unjustly. But I did also get this lovely piece from my friend Jalil Muntakim, who is now in his 47th year in imprisonment for a crime that he also most probably did not commit. And it's called The Unpragmatic Debate. It's very interesting. With some degree of amusement, I have been reading the debate between writers, scholars, and academics regarding Cornel West's critique of Ta-Nehisi Coates' analysis of black life, Obama's presidency, and the general struggle. While I am in agreement with the premise of Cornel's critique, there is a missing element. This missing element not only pertains to the critique, rather it is a broader philosophical and political issue encompassing the entire reality of black existence and struggle in America. While black America is not monolithic in sociopolitical thought, some claim this diversity in thought and practice is a strength. I firmly, unequivocally disagree. To the extent division of thought and practice has never served black folks well. Here is the crux of the West Coast debate that has yet to be resolved and won't be resolved until there is an effort to forge among black folks unified and uniform determinations in struggle. Hence, the issue before the academics and black intelligentsia is the issue of class struggle within the nation body of blacks. Failing to establish a critique on class divisions permits the type of internal static divisiveness, often to the detriment of the whole nation body. There is no wonder why neoliberals, black capitalists took one side of the debate, nationalists took another, and progressive socialists yet another. by which none in totality reached the heart of the problem. For example, in respect to Obama's residence in the White House, does anyone disagree that Obama is a black capitalist imperialist? He represented the velvet glove of the Iron Fist, the black face of U.S. militarism and white supremacy. To deny this premise would be a delusional escape from the reality that America is a white supremacist, capitalist, imperialist empire. The placement of a black person in position to represent the interest of America's hegemony only served to cast the illusion of black American inclusion in empire building. While there was a hue and cry lauding the first black president as a historical event, which it was, there was an overwhelming failure by academics, scholars, and the black intelligentsia to divorce itself from the socio-psychological and emotional significance of Obama's election with the stark socioeconomic and political reality of the system he represented. I admit to having also shed a tear embracing the historic moment, then quickly sobered up to the fact that a black face in the White House would not significantly alter or change the socioeconomic and political reality of black folks here and abroad. In fact, I wrote a prose poem, The Obama Nation, and for his second term, Obama Mania, expressing my sober concerns. In this regard, Cornell's critique of Ta-Nehisi is correct. However, Cornell West seemingly scapegoating Coates essentially relieved the entire neoliberal black capitalist class of any consequential ramifications for the continued oppression and repression of black people under the Obama administration. Ta-Nehisi Coates represents the symptom of a larger and more virulent ailment, the failure to engage in class struggle toward national unity. See, we are our own liberators, three-phase theory for national independence. The ostracizing of Coates should lend to a much broader discussion by writers, academia, and scholars on their purpose when the black body continues to be under racist assault. Is simply talking about these issues in the abstract enough, absent an analysis of the entire exploitative system producing these destructive genocidal conditions and an action plan of resistance? When the black intelligentsia are divided into neoliberal capitalist imperialists, cultural nationalists, and or progressive socialist camps, we find the majority of black folks similarly divided in their personal and collective aspirations. It's just that simple. Thus, we find ourselves in a quandary whereby white neoliberals find themselves in a spasm of delight witnessing how their anointment of Coates has instigated a public black intellectual paroxysm that only serves to exacerbate different divisions and the hardening of disparate camps. We've collectively forgotten the admonishment of Alhaj Malik al-Shabazz that our differences should be hashed out behind closed doors and to emerge to the public as a united front. If there are any lessons to be learned from the historic debates between Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington, W.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., at minimum it should be the above-mentioned admonishment. My point is that to inhibit liberals or conservatives of any persuasion to negatively impact black folks' effort to unite, our intelligentsia will need to discern what is ultimately in the best interest of black folks by engaging in class struggle. That is the task going forward. That is the call to action to the black intelligentsia, if in fact they hold an unabated love for black freedom. We have come to an era in which Dr. King, on April 4, 1967, informed that a revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth, from government policy of what Dr. King identified as the triple threats of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism. So I raise the questions. Are these the times in which the black intellectual community should focus on and devise the means and methods to prevent the destructive ramifications of the triple evils? Is it time for the black intelligentsia to rise to the challenge of forging a revolutionary value and morality that seeks to challenge this government, rather than postulating personal critiques absent the organizational or institutional basis to rectify errors in socioeconomic and political analyses? If so, then a call needs to be made by the most progressive black intellectuals to establish a national consensus on political development and policy, opposing the plethora of anti-black conditions confronting black folks. It is time for the black intelligentsia to come out of their comfort zones, ivy towers, officious statuses, and bridge the manifestation of theory into pragmatic nation building. Failing to do so is tantamount to intellectual cowardice in the face of white supremacy's violent resurgence. Revolutionary Love and Unity, Jaleel A. Montekin.
Thank you so much for that, Anne. And
yeah.
I say we begin with unity. We
exactly.
have to unify on the subject of freeing our political prisoners, the best among us, as progressive people. And we must be very clear that progressive people, brothers and sisters, are those who understand oppression and are willing to take a stand against us. We
I
know that we are the ones who are killed most on the streets and in our schools and in our institutions, but we must recognize who our allies are and who they are not. Sister Betty.
Thank you very much. Without further ado, we're going to go straight to Brother Tom. Your mic is open. We need everybody to be cognizant of the time. We want to try and get everyone in. Brother Tom, your mic is open.
Thank you very much. I'd like to talk a little. Sister Betty has recommended another book written by Professor Gerald Horn. I believe, Sister Betty, the title is The Apocalypse of, what was the full title, Betty?
Oh, you're going to have to give me time to find that for you, Tom.
Oh, that's okay.
It was...
Anyway, I have read another book by Professor Horn about 1776, the counter-revolution, and why Professor Horn calls the American Revolution, it was not a social revolution, it was a counter-revolution. It was a revolution to maintain and extend slavery in the 13 colonies. Because the British government was beginning to have second thoughts about the future of slave labor, and that was underlined by the untenable situation that existed in the Caribbean islands. So those were the big money makers, but you had a situation in the islands where 95% of the population were black slaves, and 5% were the white slave owners, landowners, and bureaucrats and managers. And this was an untenable situation sooner, because there were slave rebellions in the not only in the Caribbean islands, but also on the mainland in the 13 colonies. And these were getting to the point where the British realized that they had to have come up with another system, changing from out-and-out slave labor to wage wage slavery. And the colonists in the 13 colonies, they could not abide this. So that was a major cause of the American Revolution, to get out from under the British domination, because they feared that sooner or later slave labor will be changed to wage slavery. Now, the problem is, how are you going to convince ordinary, say, the small farmers that constituted the majority of the population at that time, how are you going to convince them to fight in a revolution to maintain slave labor in the southern colonies? Well, the problem is, of course, there were so many contradictions in capitalism that the economy of the northern colonies was also falling apart. most of the land in the northern colonies were already taken up by big landowners, and so what would happen to these small farmers as they multiplied and their families got larger, and they had to divide the smaller their small farms up into smaller plots that would become uneconomically unfeasible. So, well, what about expanding beyond the Appalachian Mountains and taking away the lands of the indigenous? Well, the British government was against that. Why? Because the British government had a very lucrative business going with the indigenous in the Ohio and Mississippi and Great Lakes area dealing with furs. They did not want white colonists. They forbade white colonists from going over the Appalachians and settling in those areas. So that was another reason. That was the reason that the leaders of the American Revolution was able to get organize an army among white small farmers, and they knew that if they won this revolution, they would have a free hand to go over the Appalachians and confiscate the lands of the indigenous. And that this is the kind of history that you will never get in our public school system or even in the universities, in our movies, because it is in the interest of this capitalist elite to brainwash and confuse the minds of the majority of the people. And they can only do this by suppressing what really happened in history. So the challenge
Tom,
how do we get the word out to the majority of people in this country? That is our big challenge.
Thank you for that, and you have been very clear, and I would suggest that if people want to go into the history, they should look at the 15 original colonies and look at Florida, West Florida and East Florida, and the question of slavery. They got rid of slavery way before the Americans got rid of slavery. That was the Spanish conquerors, and that became a problem. But that's for another program, Sister Betty.
Okay, once again, we're moving right along because we've got a long list of people waiting. Brother Joel, your mic is open. Remember, folks, be cognizant of time. Brother Joel, your mic is open.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, and let me say again, like I said before, that it's a very great honor to be able to speak and broadcast in this medium, in this block, in this weekly convention of people who are thinking in terms of liberation, who are keeping liberation in focus, because very few people right now are keeping it in focus on any media. And in fact, we have the mass media that is more and more brainwashing people into the opposite type of an outlook. And we need more. We need much more countering to that to enable people to really see through the way that they're being manipulated to their own detriment, to the way that all of us are in one form of slavery or another to the really big money people that run this country and largely run the entire world, all built around this worship of money, all built around this coercion that money creates. Money as the medium of exchange that stands between having food, having shelter, having clothing, having education, having transportation, all the necessities of life. This barrier of money stands between, and the controls of money able to exert all of that pressure on everybody to conform to their dictates. And it creates a certain mentality where money always comes first. I think last week somebody was talking about how the Volkswagen company deliberately ignored, violated, and overcame for many years emissions limits, which were designed to preserve the air, the water, and everything else against the emissions of internal combustion engines and fossil fuel burnings on a mass scale. And when they were asked, well, why did you do this? Their director said, look, it's profit. They did this for profit. In other words, they put the profits of their corporation ahead of the health of humanity. And the people that are in the positions of authority today are the people that are connected with the big money, that always put the interests of big money ahead of the necessities and health and life of the people. And this is just one small instance of that, but you have to remember that every time they generate a war, either to expand their control, to steal the resources of people around the world, and so on, or even sometimes a baseless war just for the profits of making money by selling arms to both sides and by militarizing people's minds so that under these circumstances they make a certain dent where they conform to these dictates with a militaristic mind. This is the way the system works, and when people see through this, I think that there's a necessity that people will feel that to save their own lives, this system has to be overthrown. We have to get rid of the system before it gets rid of all of us. And we have to come together in spite of whatever differences we may start out with to build that new type of a world. And I think this is what, as Ralph was speaking about, the difference between what Christianity has become and the real message that Jesus, in at least according to the story in the Bible, was crucified for. He was executed for getting out these types of ideas, for overturning the tables of the money changers, because that was really the opposite. And that word temple is a little pun there, a little double meaning, because it's not only gold that's out there, but the way that it corrupts our minds. And it's been interpreted in a lot of different ways. Usually it's interpreted to the rich and the super rich and the powerful. The religion promotes the idea that these people are the great people that we should worship and obey, and that if God didn't want them to be in power, they wouldn't be in power. And then to the poor, they say that we have to practice a form of universal nonviolence and not even self-defense, that we have to give up all of this and just obey the authorities. And
well,
it's a very good
for that,
thing.
That's right on the money as to what the system tries to do. And we do have to move on and have others speak on issues. Sister Betty.
I want to thank you, Joel, because we've got to explore more what is the conditioning of the people who are being so docile right now as the super rich take every last penny they fought for since the 1930s. Okay, Brother Rocco, your mic is open.
Oh, yes. Good evening, everyone. Sister Betty, I can't agree with you more about the reading. I'll just keep this brief. It's just a question I have after that always baffles me. I love reading lots of different history. It's very difficult finding, you know, the true history of Africa, but I'm doing my best, going to different libraries and finding out amazing things about it, you know, kingdoms going back second millennium B.C. within the sub-Sahara Africa. Anyway, all these different ancient civilizations, India, China, the indigenous people here, they had kingdoms, amazing cultures that go back thousands of years in China. My question is that always baffles me is, well, if you take England and America, and you take you add up their time as imperial countries, basically you could start about 1500 on, where England is pretty much an imperial country, and then America takes over at about 1800. But in that time period alone, just about 500 years combined, the amount of destruction that always baffles me, the amount of destruction done on all of these ancient civilizations, such a short period of time, is unfathomable. So the question I always ask is, what is this savagery that has been developed in a country like America? Why? Now, we can say that it's the modern weaponry, but it's beyond that. We could say it's profiteering, it's greed, but there's something else that's just underlying that never seems to be analyzed and understood, according to me, what I believe. So that's just the question I just wanted to pose. What is this savagery in such a short period of time, maybe 200 years, that a country like this can cause untold barbarity across the whole world, basically two countries combined, England and America.
Right. I'd like to thank you very much. Thank you for that question. One of the answers is, look at the history of Europe, war after war after war, and we in this country in this day honor the Vikings. Everyone wants to be a Viking. I don't know where it comes from. There are many books on it. Man's inhumanity to man. When culture meets culture. These are a lot of questions. But the gunpowder, the modern weapons, enabled those who had those attitudes, the European attitude. And I'm not going to say it didn't happen in Africa and China. Those who have had the attitudes are in control because they used weapons of mass destruction. And we must understand that, and we must be people willing to fight that. It will not go away by itself. We must fight it. We must educate. And no revolution ever failed if the people supported it. And so we have to get people to support change and bring change about because, as I've always said, if I couldn't do a better job of democracy than those who are in charge now, I wouldn't bother. We're looking to do a better, decent, moral job of working for the control of government by people. Thanks again, Rocco.
I really appreciate your analysis, Rocco. I appreciate anything that starts with a question because sometimes it's not in the answer, it's in the questioning. I'd like to say that the mic is open for 347, and the last four digits are 9631. And we have another guest that's also waiting, 0525 are the last four digits. So 9631, your mic is open. Look at your phone, 9631, your mic is open. Hello, 347-9631. Okay, we'll come back to you. 212, last four digits, 0525. Your mic is open. Hello? 212. Last four digits, 0525. Your mic is open.
And if people are not interested in speaking, just merely say so. We move on.
Okay. As you know, it's very rare that we have a situation that Mamiya does not react to. So before we go back to office, I'd like you to listen to this.
Like every president before him, Donald Trump announced that the State of the Union is strong. His Queen's accent giving a double count to the last word. But this is what presidents suspected to say. Could you imagine an American president saying anything else? What if a president dared speak a simple truth that the State of the Union is broken? With that, it was. If politics is part pageantry, it's also essentially the art of division between parties. One party crows, the other party simmers. That great student of America, Alexis de Tocqueville, in his classic 1835 work, Democracy in America, opined, the parties by which the Union is menaced do not rest on abstract principles, but upon temporal interests. These interests, disseminated in the provinces of so vast an empire, may be said to constitute rival nations rather than parties. De Tocqueville was writing these words just a few years before the Union burst into its bloodiest war, the U.S. Civil War. He was feeling and sensing in the air a great discontent, like now. The discontent, often due to the steering pot of politics by Trump, is palpable. Party versus party, nation versus nation. Disunity, the very essence of politics. Trump, his chin jutting into the air, projected the politics of fear of others, mostly of Brown. If politics is part pageantry, it's also essentially the art of division between parties. One party crows, the other party simmers. That great student of America, Alexis de Tocqueville, in his classic 1835 work, Democracy in America, opined, the parties by which the Union is menaced do not rest on abstract principles, but upon temporal interests. These or that it was. If politics is part pageantry, it's also essentially the art of division between parties. One party crows, the other party simmers. That great student of America, Alexis de Tocqueville, in his classic 1835 work, Democracy in America, opined, the parties by which the Union is menaced do not rest on abstract principles, but upon temporal interests. These interests, if politics is part pageantry, it's also essentially the art of division between parties. One party crows, the other party simmers. That great student of America, Alexis de Tocqueville, in his classic 1835 work, Democracy in America, opined, the parties by which the Union is menaced do not rest on abstract principles, but upon temporal interests.
Okay, and we understand what those temporal interests are. And speak books that we should read. There's a new book out by Jean Theo Harris, and she uses a quote from James Baldwin, A More Beautiful and Terrible History. That is talking about America. And when he says the more beautiful, he's talking about the possibilities of change. He talks about the people who had courage to to fight for change. And but he also talks about the history that we are not told of, the terrible history of slavery. And it continues, and I think of the young soldiers who believe that they are fighting for America, and they go to foreign wars and come home crippled and injured. And we see the very rich people in America do not support them. They appeal to the average American, who they appeal to their goodness to support them in their troubles, in their terrible injuries, never thinking that they didn't go to war for the people. They went to war for the interest of the super rich who care not about them. I think that we must always put that in front of the public, but we must also understand the pink elephant in the room that has been nurtured and grown by those, the moneyed class, and that is the pink elephant called racism. It's in the room. It is the bottom of everything. And we see that Trump gets up and he speaks, and we all know what he's talking about: racism, exclusion of the immigrants, and they don't say racism. He uses other terms, but we understand perfectly what he's talking about, and the very idea that their Democrats are still talking about Russian influence. I'm amazed. Russian influence in American politics, and they sell that to a public that I guess they sanction America getting involved in everyone else's election, nullifying their elections, overthrowing their governments, and yet a major party uses as a foundation for their angst that Russia somehow is involved in the election of America, and they forget what, or they refuse to say what got Trump elected. We see racism. They refuse to discuss the election in, I believe it was Georgia. Was it Moore? The University of Alabama, Birmingham, the Moore issue, with Trump supporting a pedophile, a racist, etc., and the people, you know, at Birmingham and in Alabama, many supported him. So how do we get through, not to that class, but to the people who have a bit of an ability to understand? Will they understand that every day that America prints money, the money they have is worth less? And there was a study done not too long ago that said, how many hours does a person have to work today, if they are fortunate enough to have a job, to equal the 10 years ago? And the answer is they have to work 14 hours instead of 8 hours to maintain that form of life that they had years ago. And so when you see that stock market go up and down, when you see the deficit going off the charts, it does affect us. Our dollars become worth less if we are fortunate enough to have a job, work longer at that job to maintain that lifestyle. And we must remember our job is to educate, 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 organize, 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 and support our political prisoners. Those are the people who saw a problem and acted to solve the problem, and we lost the struggle. That's why we are in this position, and so therefore, our job today, everyone must work to educate, organize, and support our political prisoners.
Before we leave, we just want to say to the family of Richard Mafungwe, continue our conferences, and we are heartbroken that we failed to free, to liberate this beautiful brother. He was found on the floor of his cell. His wife, Carolyn, says he suffered from various health conditions and had had 3 strokes in the past. And yet this government found this man a threat. So we want to send our condolences out to the Richard Mafunde Lake family. And I'm sure if you go to Jericho, you will definitely find out where you can send a donation and a message of condolences. In addition to that, please put Matula Shakur on your calendar for April. He's coming up for another hearing. We have got to bring this brother home. All of you who believe in practicing whatever your faith is, get your pastor, your rabbi, your imam to contact the prison authorities and tell them to turn this brother loose. Thank you. And on that note, we really want to send a shout out to all of you who contributed and those who we tried to open your mic. If we did something wrong on our end, we would appreciate it if you would come back with us next week. So on that note, we will say good night, and we wish.
The whole round world to hear. I wish.